if a radical is someone who gets to the root of things, this next man is as radical as reality. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Michael Parenti.
Thank you very much. This is a unique situation for me. It's never happened before in all the lecturing I've done. I have two talks here prepared, and I don't know which one I want to give tonight. And it's about decision-making time, isn't it? So you think I should take a sense? I'm deadly serious about this. You think I should take a poll? Well, one of the talks is entitled Capitalism versus Democracy, and the other one is, and it's, and Mickey said, we're not going to hear any political science lectures tonight. And I thought, gee, I'm going to give a political science. I was trained as a political scientist. I describe myself now as a recovering academic. I no longer teach, and not in academia, but it's not easy to teach in academia sometimes. So that's one talk. The other one is called Empires Past and Present. Which one of those should I give now? All right, let's take a poll. How many want the first subject? Okay, how many want the second? Okay, we're going to do the second then, I think. It's a... they both speak to the same truth, ultimately, you see. Okay? I never did that before. I can't believe I just did that. Well, I want to talk about empire. Anyway, empire is really in the air. It's an important subject, as you know. We live in one, so we might as well give it some attention. I'm from those generations of Americans who were taught that to think of empire and imperialism. Imperialism is the process of empire. It's the carrying out of empire. I was taught to think of empire and imperialism as something that other countries do, that our country didn't do that. There was a Roman Empire, there was a British Empire, a Spanish Empire, a Mongol Empire. There was, of course, most sinister of all, a Soviet empire, which lurked everywhere and was devouring the world, and we had to be eternally vigilant about it. But there was no American empire. And when I wrote a book called Against Empire in 1995, and Lawrence Ferlinghetti designed the cover, actually, it was rather nice. He put an American flag across a picture of the globe, and showing this global empire. I mean, that was considered, you know, a radical, extreme thing. Now, you know, in the late 18th, early 19th centuries, people like Jefferson and Monroe and Adams, they used the word empire. It was a more neutral term. They talked about the American empire. They anticipated that its dominion would extend all over North America and maybe Mexico and Central America, that this would all become America at some point. But by the late 19th and throughout the 20th century, empire took on a more pejorative tone. When President William McKinley in 1898, with force of arms, stole or took Cuba, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and Guam from Spain, and more importantly, took them from the Filipino people and the Cuban people and the Puerto Rican people and the Guam people, he said with much satisfaction, and I found the notation, McKinley was a very slippery guy. He never put anything on paper. But he had a personal secretary who recorded a lot of the stuff, and I was in the presidential papers in the Library of Congress, and I came across it. He said with great satisfaction, he said, in 3 months, we have become a world power. And that was, but he didn't say, in 3 months, we have become an empire, which was also true. Because the U.S., to take the Philippines, had to kill 200,000 or more people and fight a war that lasted about 7 years, with some holdouts going even longer than that, and killing hundreds of thousands of civilians there. I also was taught when I was a kid that the U.S. didn't have colonies. We didn't have colonies. There were colonies all over the place. You used to look at a globe and you could see all the pink on the globe. That was the British Empire, and the blue was the French Empire, and you could see it's the green and whatever else. The world was getting sliced up by the European powers. But the U.S., we had territories. They were called territories or possessions. But they weren't colonies. We didn't have colonies. And the denial was made all the easier by the innovation of a whole new method of global rule, which earned the name of neocolonialism or neo-imperialism. And this was devised, the first practitioners of it were the Americans in the Sandwich Islands. They did it as a first term, which McKinley grabbed. He took the Sandwich Islands, better known to you as Hawaii, and then gave them a kind of independence, so the queen came in and all that. But all the plantations, all the land, all the wealth of Hawaii was owned by the Americans. And the next place they did it was in Cuba in about 1904 or so. The U.S. leaders went to the Cubans and they said, look, we stole you fair and square from the Spaniards, but we're a republic. It doesn't look good, us having a colony here occupied with American bayonets and all that. So we're going to give you your independence. Independence. Comprende? Independence. Yes, yes, don't shake your head. No, no, we're serious. Don't laugh, we're serious. You're going to have your own flag. It's going to be red, white, and blue. But you get only one star because you're just a little island, you know. Someday you might have more, but... And you're going to have your own presidente, and you're going to have your own currency. You don't have to use U.S. dollars. You can have your own currency, and you can have your own leaders on the money. You don't have to have George Washington. We're flexible. And you have your National Guard, which will train and equip and all that. And the only thing we get in return, the only thing is we'll control all your imports and exports, and we'll own your sugar industry and your tobacco industry and your oil refineries and your nickel mining industry, and we'll control all your relationships with third nations. Okay, fair. And we'll also control your tourist industry. We'll own it. I mean, we'll own all that. So neocolonialism, I mean, this was 50 years before the British thought of doing this in India. You know, the Americans were already practicing this because they were not empire builders. They were not world leaders. They were first and foremost, they were capital financial investors. Their goal was to use the land, the labor, the markets, the natural resources of the whole world for the capital accumulation process. Their goal was to transform living nature into dead capital through commodification and sales, of course. Well, why should the U.S. be called an empire? I mean, isn't it enough to call it a superpower? But it's a superpower that exercises that power through direct and indirect intervention into the affairs of other countries to actually change the direction and the development and the structures and the interior conditions and the political arrangements and the social institutions of those other countries. That's what the United States has been doing in country after country after country after country. Lawless, aggressive interventions, invasions, Panama, Grenada, Iraq, Yugoslavia, destroying and tearing up Yugoslavia into a little cluster of right-wing republics, a country that had an economy that was 80% in the public sector, which was multi-ethnic, and people were living pretty much in peace with much intermingling, dividing it up, instigating the most retrograde nationalist elements in all of them, breaking them up, intervening in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere. There's no communist country. There's no rogue nation. There's no axis of evil that has a record of criminal intervention like the one that has been perpetrated by the U.S. imperialists in recent years. Just in Latin America, we can think of Guatemala, Rios Montt, destroying 600 Mayan villages. Now, why does Rios Montt, and why does that deranged murder machine known as the Guatemalan army kill all these people, 200,000 people killed in Guatemala? They didn't just do it themselves. They were trained, advised, equipped, and supported by the U.S. national security state. In El Salvador, again, what, 80,000 killed or more. In Honduras, death squads and all. And they don't kill at random. They kill union leaders. They kill farm leaders, student leaders, clergymen, journalists, community leaders, other people who were questioning and challenging the status quo and U.S. material hegemony. Let's talk about an area that Americans don't really give as much attention to. I mean, some of us know about the sins of that have been perpetrated in Latin America, but let's talk about Africa. Cynthia McKinney, as an African American, talked at length about Italy and the atrocities committed by the U.S. government there. I, as an Italian American, will talk at length about Africa. But it's more than just a return courtesy. It's because I think it's an urgent question. Oh, we are so multi. I like it. You know, African leaders who were invited to the G8 gathering, they really expressed, in 1999, they really expressed deep disappointment that the plan did nothing to open Western markets to African goods, did nothing to cancel debts of the poorest countries that were crippling them, or provide the financial aid needed to meet the UN's targets for tackling global poverty by 2015. The US government, through the Pentagon, the CIA, the World Bank, and the IMF, has systematically demolished African economies. You know, African economies were developing there for a while. There were some of these countries, I was talking to a guy, he says, you know, things are happening in Africa. This was about 20 years ago. He said, we used to get leather from Africa. We used to get hides. Then we started getting finished leather. Then we started getting leather products like purses and shoes and very good ones. And this sort of thing's happening. Now, that was sort of encouraged when the U.S. was in competition, or thought they were, with the Soviet Union, and they wanted to build up stable economies in the middle class. We didn't want the countries to be too poor, because otherwise if they were too poor, they would what? Go communist. Boom, boom, boom. You know, they didn't want that to happen. So there was a tolerance. But after the Soviet Union and the other communist countries were overthrown, and many here on the left said, oh, this is a golden opportunity. Oh, things are going to be so much better. We've gotten rid of that Stalinist albatross around our necks. And now people will turn to us and they will see everything so much better and all that. Well, it wasn't that way at all. Two things happened. One was, we don't have to tolerate any social contract with our own working class. We don't have to go to them and say, see how much better you have it than the Soviet worker. You can buy a television set a lot quicker than he does, and this and that, and all those things. You got a car and he doesn't. And all that. We don't have to tolerate that. And we don't have to tolerate development in the third world anymore. We can go back to being what we really are in our essence, which is colonialists, imperialists, empire builders. And they systematically demolished the African economies, health and education sectors. They fueled 11 wars on the continent with arms transfers and military training. This imperial strategy has killed more than 4 million Africans, almost 2 million in Angola, 900,000 in Mozambique, and hundreds and hundreds of thousands at other places. Africa's a big deal. Almost 80% of the strategic minerals that the U.S. requires are found in Africa, including cobalt, platinum, gold, chromium, manganese, uranium, And oil, by the way. Africa isn't that far behind the Middle East in providing U.S. oil. Middle East gives us 25% of our oil from the Persian Gulf. Africa gives the U.S. 18%. Africa is the most war-torn region in the world. During the 1990s, 32 African countries out of the 53 that there are witnessed violent conflict. And in almost every one of those cases, the U.S. was behind it, arming different groups, spent $1.5 billion in arms and training to African militarists during the Cold War years up to 1989. And that set the stage for the current round of conflicts in the region. The Clinton administration, following the end of the Cold War, undertook a wave of new military training programs in Africa. That's what Africa needs, more guns, more military training. From 1991 to 95, the U.S. gave military assistance to 50 countries in Africa out of the 53. And one could go on. A good article on that by Assad Ismi. So this is what... This is what empire does. This is the effects of it. Now, in recent years, it's actually become acceptable to refer to the U.S. as an empire. It's actually become acceptable among mainstream writers and conservative writers, some of them. And any number of them, I've heard it more than once coming up, and they're saying that, well, we're the strongest nation in the world, and we have every right to act as such. There's a guy who wrote in the Harvard magazine, I forget his name now, he said, America is an empire, and let's get used to that, and let's start acting like an empire. I mean, so it was, not only do they say America is an empire, but they say it in a celebratory way. If this is something, gee, isn't this great? So that the power, the awareness of having this unanswerable power, gives them a sense of entitlement, gives them a sense of mission, gives them this sense of going forth. And ordinary Americans, too, if you talk to them, they'll say to you, this country is unique. It's different. There's no country like it, and it's the greatest country in the world. There's no country like it in the world. It has a history that is so exceptional. And you know what my answer is? My answer is, it does have a history that's remarkably exceptional. And so does every country. Did you ever think of the history of Great Britain? The history of France? The history of Italy? The history of Egypt? The history of Nigeria? I mean, go history of Mexico. They all have exceptional, fascinating, incredible histories of culture, of atrocities and horrors and injustices and human survival and all sorts of things that have happened. They all have that. But this is the greatest. This country is going to lead the world. They've decided. Well, you know, there are all sorts of countries have had that view too. In thinking that we are so exceptional, Americans are very unexceptional. In thinking we are unique in history, we're very ununique, because almost all countries think they're unique, you know? That's all through history. You can read Michelet and the French nationalists of the 19th century, and they talk about France as being the gift of the French Revolution, and Michelet makes the point that nothing really reaches the world stage in art or literature or politics until it arrives in Paris and becomes an issue in Paris. And there was some truth sort of to that, and that Paris, that France would lead the world, you know, égalité, fraternité, liberté. Something to be a Frenchman now is to be a leader of the world. The Indian National Congress in the 19th century. You could read their statements. I wish I had brought a quote of theirs. It's fantastic to talk about that India has a special mission to all of humankind. India, with its spirituality, with its legacy, will save the world from the crass materialism and corruption of the Western ways and all that sort of thing. The early German nationalists like Fichte and Treitschke, you hear them talk about Germany with its Macht, will move forward with its intellectual powers. The German universities, scholars all over the world came to the German universities to study, and Germany would really move ahead, unify itself with steel and blood, and save the world from the spiritual corruption and lassitude and indulgences that were going on. You can read Mazzini. Mazzini talks about Italy doing that. A reunified Italy will emerge, and now it will lead all the old decadent ways of Europe and save them, just as Italy was supreme and during the Roman Empire, and then for 1,000 years with the Vatican and the Christian Empire. Now a new Italy will arise, and it'll be for democracy and the family of nations, and it'll bring world leadership like the Italians had nothing else to worry about. They were going to follow Mazzini in this world vision. Well, it didn't happen, of course. He was a general without an army, but you can go on, you know. So this idea that we have a certain virtue. I remember talking to a kind of a middle American audience it was at Fort Mason in San Francisco, and they were startled to hear that other people had the same view of their countries that we have about ours. It really shakes you, because you think not only that your country is unique, but this is a unique idea. This is the first time, and then when you hear that others have had it, that makes you wonder, well, wait a minute, then is it so certain, so unique? Is it so unique, you know? Well, and they don't stop telling us, these conservatives, calling us to empire. Then not only does this power give us a certain entitlement, but this power gives us an obligation. It's out of necessity. We've got to move. It's a mantle that's been thrown upon our shoulders by history. The U.S. was thrusted into the role of world leader. I've heard that again and again. I've always seen that verb. The U.S. reluctantly was thrusted into this role and had to pick up the obligations of world leader. They never said who did the thrusting, you know? Who did? They never pointed out that it was the guys up there in the national security state who were planning this thing all along, pushing it all along. Well, there's a question here. And that question is, why are there empires? I mean, why are these empires? One of the interesting things about liberal bourgeois scholarship, and one of the interesting things about mainstream pundits, and one of the interesting things about most policymakers or publicists or opinion makers, is they teach you implicitly, by continual neglect and continually programming it out, they teach you not to ask why. Why? I heard a talk once on the Mongol Empire about Genghis Khan. They conquered here, and then they conquered there, and they went as far as here, and in this year they were here. And I remember raising the question, I said, why did they do that? These guys just say, come on, let's get on our horses and just go out there and do it. What is it about? It's just, well, they just go out and they conquer, because that's what empires do, you know. That's what the imperialists do. But why? Is it conquest just for conquest's sake? Is it power just for power's sake? Not really. It's very rarely. Of course, maybe the leader will get, you know, feel more elevated when he can grab another province or another territory and extend the rule and all that. The Roman Empire was full of that, of course. The flag wavers were there then too, and talked about Pax Romana and how we will, Roman law and Roman rule will extend. And there's beautiful quotes about we go in there even-handedly, and we all these people eventually almost willingly join, and then they willingly do come and give themselves over to our empire because they have security and this wonderful rule and law. Not a word about the shattered armies, the burned crops, the slaughtered herds, the raped women, the enslavement of populations and prisoners, all that. And when you read a little closer, that book I just wrote, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, I deal with these questions of empire and during the late Republic. There were some very real material interests at stake. Plunder, tribute, all sorts of resources, all sorts of new markets, expropriating the land, the crops, the cheap labor, in this case the slave labor. Empires are enormously profitable. Empires are also enormously costly. There have been studies showing that the Japanese Empire was much more costly than anything they ripped off from Manchuria or China or the Philippines or wherever else. There have been studies showing that the British Empire, in fact, Karl Marx pointed out that the British Empire in India, what it cost the Brits to keep India and hold on to it, was more than what the Brits got out of India. So empire is irrational. So the material factor, parenti, is not real. Because if it costs more, then it's not a material motivation. No, it is. It is because, as Marx went on, and Thorsten Veblen made this point also, and I've made this point in regard to the Philippines when, what's his name? You reach that certain age, then names just... No, it doesn't matter. Anyway, an economist whose name will come to me tonight at about 11:30 or so. He pointed out in the Philippines that the U.S. investment in the Philippines was $5 billion. And the cost over 25 years, an aid and military bases, et cetera, that was $10 billion. So what kind of an investment? Spending $10 billion for $5 billion. But a number of us have pointed out, it's a great investment. Because the $5 billion belongs to one class of people, and the $10 billion is spent by the other class of people. So empires are enormously profitable for the investing class. They are enormously costly for the common populace. We pay for it. And you see, they'll spend $10 of your money to protect $5 of their money. They'll spend $20, $50, $100. They'll spend $155 billion between February and today in Iraq of your money to protect Halliburton and Bechtel and the oil company's investment in Iraq right now. Because when it comes to protecting their money, your money's no object. They'll spend it like nothing. So the empire... the empire feeds off the republic's resources. The people pay the taxes. They do without services so that the patricians can pursue their far-off plunder. E. Badian, speaking of Rome's imperial class during the late republic, the republic was an empire. You can have a republic and it can still be an empire. You don't need a king. He says, quote, "No administration in history has ever devoted itself so wholeheartedly to fleecing its subjects for the private benefit of its ruling class as Rome of the late age of the republic," unquote. Now, he wrote this 30 years before George Bush and what's going on today, of course. You'd have to revise that a little bit. Along with expropriating the markets, the land, the labor, the resources of these other countries, which is the essence of imperialism, along with that, there is the need to prevent these countries from going their own way, from pursuing paths of self-development and self-definition, from trying to get out from under the neoliberal global investment model. From trying to say, no, our country is not here as just a cow for you to milk anytime you want, on any terms that you want. The need today for the global imperialists is to keep nations from getting out from under the neoliberal free market global system. That's what it was with Iraq. That's what it was with Yugoslavia, with Panama, Grenada, Libya. Take the case of Libya. I want to say something about it. In the 1980s, suddenly all over the press, all in the media, there were these images of this man who was called a madman, worse than Hitler, insane. His name was Omar Gaddafi, the leader of Libya. And everywhere I went, you know, when I was giving talking, people were Gaddafiing all over the place. What about Gaddafi? What about Gaddafi? 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 Hey, what about Gaddafi? Gaddafi going to get your mama? Gaddafi? What are we going to do? I said, what Gaddafi? What? What? 3 months ago, you never even heard of this guy. 3 months ago, you would have had a little struggle to find Libya on the map. Now suddenly you're convinced that Omar Gaddafi and Libya, a country of 3 or 4 million people with an army that's a little bit bigger than the LAPD, is a mortal threat to the safety and security and survival of the United States. I mean, it's really remarkable. And your leaders are going to protect you from this menace. And the gap that exists between what Americans think their leaders are doing in the world and what those leaders really are doing is one of the great propaganda victories of modern times. Gaddafi's real sin was that he conducted a revolution in Libya, in a country that had a social structure like Saudi Arabia, a few obscenely rich families that owned all the oil, sold it off to the Americans, I mean, in total collusion with the Americans, owned it with the Americans, while the mass of the people lived in utter poverty. Gaddafi and his colonel's rebellion came in, kicked those families out, and he started doing things like nationalizing the oil industry, actually saying, by the way, this is what Saddam Hussein did too, you know, the oil industry in Iraq is nationalized. I mean, this is infuriating to U.S. leaders. The idea that these people think that our oil, which happens to be in their ground, is something that they're going to take from us, you see. And Gaddafi started using that money for forestation, for health clinics, for schools, and all sorts of other kinds of things. He was self-developing. He was creating a country that was not sitting there impoverished servitude to the global investors. And suddenly he was demonized all over the place. And that's what our people are told. They are told a different story. They're told that we have to be everywhere, that these leaders, our U.S. leaders, have to intervene everywhere, Africa, Asia, Latin America, all the time, because there are these threats to our security. There are these mortal dangers. We have to go also to bring democracy to these people, to teach them how to rule. We have to go to Iraq to teach them how to have a civic society. Here's a 5,000-year-old civilization like they didn't know until the Americans have come. And now they don't have any fresh water or electricity. They don't have jobs. They don't have any security. I mean, security of person. I mean, the crime, the gangs that are going around. We have to go to get rid of bad dictators, and we have to go for global peace and well-being. And unfortunately, too many of our compatriots, who are perfectly cynical about politicians, most politicians justifiably, they'll say things like, oh, most politicians, they'll tell you one thing, and then when they get in office, they do something else, or they pretend they're for the ordinary guy, but then they get in and they help their pals and the fat cats. So you hear people say those things. But when those very same politicians wrap themselves around in the flag, when they point to some external menace or some vital involvement we have to do, when they start manufacturing foreign crises, then people fall into line and follow the leader. Not only that, but think of it as a sign of your loyalty and patriotism to do that. Don't take my word for it. Let's hear from a member of the U.S. ruling class. John Forster Dulles. John Forster Dulles was a rich corporate New York lawyer. Dulles Brothers of New York. Multi-millionaire. His brother, Alan Dulles, was director of the CIA, also of Dulles Brothers. Another way, a director of the CIA under the Eisenhower administration and sometime later. John Forster was Secretary of State under Eisenhower. And this is what he said. He's a conservative Republican who gives us a moment of truth about the empire's falsehood and manipulation. Quote, in order to bring a nation to support the burdens of maintaining great military establishments, it is necessary to create an emotional state akin to war psychology. There must be the portrayal of external menace. Let's repeat that one. There must be the portrayal of external menace. This involves the development to a high degree of the nation hero, nation villain. You know, the hero nation and the villainous nation. This villain-hero ideology and the arousing of the population to a sense of sacrifice. Once these exist, we have gone a long way on the path to war. Unquote. You can say, well, look, we had real threats. I mean, you know, we had September 11 and such. Yeah, there are real enemies now. But have you listened to what they say? And are we creating these enemies? When you go into the Middle East and you destroy every democratic movement, every progressive movement, every popular movement in Turkey, in Syria, in Iraq, in Iran, in Lebanon, and you dismantle these countries, and you destroy not only those things, you destroy their future. Don't you think they're going to start hating you? Bill Blum, who you'll be hearing from tomorrow, he collected a number of quotes from the terrorists. Because what we hear here, and I debated a guy on TV, it was down in L.A., some cable TV network, he said, these terrorists hate us because we're free, we're prosperous, we're secular. And he said, these terrorists hate me because I'm free, I'm prosperous, I'm secular. I forget what else. Good looking, whatever, what is fashionable, and isn't it? But Bill, you remember that article you wrote? I found a couple of other things myself of actual discussions, interviews with the terrorists. The ones from 1993 who had bombed the World Trade Center the first time, they didn't say, oh, we're bombing this place because you're so free and you're so prosperous and you're so well-dressed and you're not Islamic and we're just so jealous. Ooh, and that's why we're killing you. That isn't why they did it. Robert Fisk had this interview of Osama bin Laden in 1998, 3 years before September 11. And they didn't say that. They all said the same thing. They all said, if the U.S. would leave us alone, if the U.S. would get out of here, get out of the Middle East, and stop trying to undermine our countries, destroying our cultures, we would leave them alone. They've waged war on us for so long, we've got to take the war home to them. That's what it was about. So, you know, you can to really see what motivates them, you might give some attention to what they actually say. I mean, they don't attack Denmark. Denmark is free and prosperous, a lot freer than us, a lot more prosperous than us. There isn't the kind of homelessness that we're going to have to be facing tomorrow and all, or every day in Berkeley. It costs me $2.50 to take a walk in Berkeley downtown, giving money. I'm not kidding you. It's the saddest thing. I mean, a few quarters here, a few quarters there and all that. In 1919, I'm going to end here just with two more quotes. In 1919, a noted conservative economist named Joseph Schumpeter presented this picture of the ancient Roman Empire, of Roman imperialism. Now, this is Schumpeter writing in 1919 about ancient Rome. Rome pursued that policy which pretends to aspire to peace, but unerringly generates war. The policy of continual preparation for war. The policy of meddlesome interventionism. There was no corner of the known world where some interest was not alleged to be in danger or under actual attack. If the interests were not Roman, they were those of Rome's allies. And if Rome had no allies, then allies would be invented. The fight was always invested with an aura of legality. Rome was always being attacked by evil-minded neighbors, always fighting for a breathing space. The whole world was pervaded by a host of enemies, and it was manifestly Rome's duty to guard against their aggressive designs. They were enemies who only waited to fall upon the Roman people. Does that sound a little familiar to you at all? Yeah. This other quote I want to read is by a man who once served in the U.S. Senate. He wasn't a Democrat and he wasn't a Republican. He was a populist. And he served in the Senate in 1898 when the Spanish-American War was going on. The populace had really developed a good deal of strength. They had about three or four Senate seats. They had a number of governorships. And they had a number of seats in the House of Representatives. Maybe, I forget now, 10, 15, maybe more, 20. And they were mostly, they were strong, especially in the South and the West. And Watson was from Georgia. And this is what he says. Now, this is 1898. He says, "The Spanish War has finished us. The blare of the bugle has drowned the voice of the reformer." "Who gets the benefit of this war?" he asked. And this is the way he answered. "The bond seekers, the capitalists, the railroads. National bankers will profit by this war. The new bonds give them the basis for new banks, and their power is prolonged. The privileged classes all profit by this war. It takes the attention of the people off economic issues and perpetuates the unjust system they have put upon us. Politicians profit by the war. It buries issues they dare not meet. What do the people get out of this war? The fighting and the taxes. What is the United States doing in this war with Spain in the first place? True, Spain is oppressing Cuba, but so is England oppressing Ireland, Egypt, and India. France is oppressing Siam and Madagascar. Turkey is oppressing Armenia. Should we then take up arms against the oppressors of the world? We would more likely end by becoming oppressors ourselves. The Spaniards and Cubans were bushwhacking one another and killing from 3 to 5 men at a battle. We have gone down there and killed more people in 3 months than they would have killed in 13 years. If they were starving before, who feeds them now? What are we going to get out of this war as a nation? Endless trouble, complications, expense. Republics cannot go into the conquering business and remain republics. Militarism leads to military domination, military despotism. Imperialism smooths the way for the emperor. And as we know, in every president there's an emperor that's just dying to get out, you know? Well, that's right, I don't have an ending for this. For this one, but let me just say this. In February of 2003, there was a remarkable movement. You know, it was unprecedented. All over the world, millions, literally millions upon millions of people demonstrated. It's estimated that over 10 million people demonstrated all over the world, and there were millions more in total sympathy against the U.S. going into Iraq. I strongly supported, and of course I was out on the demonstrations, and I endorsed, and so forth, and I spoke at one or two, but strongly endorsed those demonstrations, and there were all sorts of people say, "Well, is this going to do any good? Is it going to stop?" I said, "Absolutely not. It's not going to stop him from going into the war." "Well, what's the good then? What's the good of it?" "Oh, it's very good. We've got to do it." And in fact, it influenced how they conducted that war. Rumsfeld, for instance, he canceled all sorts of military redundancy plans and attack programs. He said, "We've got to go in on a lighter footprint." They dropped the whole shock and awe, that awful genocidal thing where they would blast the whole country and leave it, the entire population, totally stunned and then just waltz in. It's influenced how they've conducted themselves. Right now they could do free fire zones. They're coming close to that because they're taking such losses, and they've been killing a lot of Iraqis. My son is in Baghdad, and he's just written to me, and he said that the Iraqis are taking a terrible beating. I mean, thousands of people are getting killed. Thousands upon thousands are being arrested and detained, and homes are being violated. But they still, that's the only thing It's about the only thing that can restrain them is their sense that the mass of people in their country and throughout the world are resisting and emerging. And you saw these incredible demonstrations, I mean, in Indonesia, Lithuania, Finland, Mexico, Spain, Italy, Germany, Great Britain. In London, there was about 2 million people. They called it the largest demonstration in English history. I was there last July speaking at a conference, and they were still talking about the February demonstration. In Japan, big demonstrations in Osaka, Kyoto, and of course Tokyo, all over the... Now, these are countries, Japan, Mexico, you know, Finland, Canada. These are not countries that have a very close historical or ethnic or cultural link to Iraq. In fact, they don't have any at all to speak of. So they were demonstrating for two things. One, out of regard for the people of Iraq, that they shouldn't be subjected to yet another slaughter from U.S. bombs and such. But two, they were also demonstrating for their own sovereignty, their own democratic sovereignty. They were saying to the rulers of the planet, to the U.S. ruling elite, you have no right to act like the monarchs of the world. You have no right to violate all international law. You have no right to announce that you've discarded all treaties. You will not be held to any treaties anymore. You will do whatever you want, whenever you want. You will decide who shall live and who shall die. You will publish hit lists of nations that you're going to attack. If you are a country of this magnitude and power rampaging across the globe, none of us will be safe. None of us will be secure. And so there was this kind of response. And ultimately, brothers and sisters, ultimately, all nations, all governments, all states, to some degree or another, all states rest on public opinion, believe it or not. And if we can really mobilize people, if we can really turn them around, if we can really open their eyes, educate them, liberate them, and let them know what real patriotism is, then we have a chance to turn this around. And the more agitation, the more visibility we give to these opinions, to these demands, the more nervous they get and the more restraint they get. When the people are ready to lead, the leaders will eventually follow. Thank you very much.